Now, Saints, come with me here as we consider the final Jeopardy category of famous scorned women. Today we want to look at one, Emma Hale. You say, Brother McGovern, she can't be that famous. I never heard of her. Well, in some circles, as you shall see, she's quite famous. Emma Hale was born in July, year of our Lord, 1804, in Harmony Township, Pennsylvania, not that terribly far from New York, to Isaac and Elizabeth Hale as the seventh of nine children, all of whom were raised in the strictest of the Methodist tradition. And as a teenager, she found employment teaching school children. And by the time she was 21, however, she met this young, dashing swashbuckler named Joseph Smith Jr., who literally swept her off of her feet. And it soon became apparent to one and all that the two are an item and that they're seriously contemplating marriage. Well, Isaac Hale vehemently disapproved of this because this young man, number one, was poorly educated, and Isaac Hale perceived that he was also lazy. He was this treasure digger, and also he was claiming to have visions of a religious nature. Oh my gosh, he knew that his daughter Emma can do just a little bit better than this. And he was not shy about protesting this arrangement, but Emma ignored it, and the two eloped, went over the state line in New York, got married, and then moved back to the community and settled in as husband and wife. And in 1830, he finished this work that he had been working on for a couple of years and copyrighted it and called it the Book of Mormon and began to start this new religion with a handful of Confederates. And they call the Church of Christ, which was later to be renamed as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and which was going to transform itself into that multi-billion dollar religious enterprise headquartered in Salt Lake City, as you know. Now, at first, life was quite a rocky road for the new couple. The parents' disapproval notwithstanding, they still tried to help them out because they were, you know, Isaac and Elizabeth Hale had modest means, tried to help out the newlyweds as much as they could. And she hung with him for the next few years. But then in the mid to late 1830s, he began to develop this roving eye for other women. And I'll say this for Emma Hale, there was a lot she could put up with for her about her husband, but this was not going to be one of them. And as the church began to grow and grow and attract new female converts, he began to act more and more like a typical man, pushing the envelope, widening the margin with these women under him who were under his authority. It got to the point where he began to openly talk about something called plural marriage. Now, this was nothing new because you had plural marriage in the Old Testament, but in this case, he was talking about plural marriage that was not only sanctioned by the God of the Bible, but which was also commanded by the God of the Bible. And one day in 1843, he even got a revelation to this effect. And it ended up as section 132 in the Doctrine and Covenants, which is one of the Mormon holy books, which I'm holding here in my hand, if I may take the liberty to read from section 132. This is supposed to be a prophecy from the God of the Bible. In verse 52, God is supposed to have said this, "And let mine handmaid Emma Smith receive all those that have been given unto my servant Joseph, and who are virtuous and pure before me. And those who are not pure and have said they were pure shall be destroyed, saith the Lord God." This is supposed to be God not only saying that this is going to be sanctioned by God, but telling Emma, hey girl, you better shape up and put up with this, and that's my will. Well, Emma would have none of this. And I'm here to tell you, she fought him every wife of the way. For three big reasons. Number one, because her beloved Book of Mormon condemns polygamy without reservation. Number two, she fully well knew her husband's nature, and she could see what he was up to. He's using God to sanitize or justify his lust. And number three, she loved him. She really, genuinely loved him, and no woman who loves him is going to share him with other women. Now, you can take this for what it's worth, but 1 year later, Joseph Smith was gunned down in June 27th, if I'm not mistaken, 1844. Was that just something that happened, or was it the judgment of God? I don't know. I wasn't there. Just read about this. We'll find out on the other side. But he died a year after this, 1843, Section 132 in the DNC revelation that he got. And then she was relegated to the column of, well, lonely woman. And she remained a lonely woman, having survived him for quite a few decades, even denying that he ever practiced polygamy, which is unbelievable, but denying to the day of her death that he ever practiced polygamy, I guess trying to safeguard him from public shame. But she did die April 30th of 1879, just 11 years before the church officially outlawed polygamy in their 1890 manifesto, which they had to do because the U.S. government was just on them like white on rice. So Emma Hale became Emma Hale Smith, and her story is, well, really somewhat melancholy. But you know, we have a similar situation in the Bible. We have another woman I want to look at today who bears a very eerie resemblance to Emma Hale Smith. In that each one was dealt this, a bad hand of cards. And that's what we want to talk about this morning. You know, at Brandywine Christian Fellowship, our core values spell out the word real, R-E-A-L. R, relationships, E, eternity consciousness, A, awareness, and L, learning. Today, we want to center on this R. Relationships. This is a message about relationships, not necessarily the kind that bring a smile to your face. So we're going to talk about a bad hand of cards. You know, human history has not been kind to women. I'm not trying to sound like a feminist or a politician who's after the women's vote, but it's true that history has not been all that kind to women. They've been victimized, they've been trodden underfoot by the stronger of the two, that is, sexes. And Western civilization has treated women perhaps a lot better than the East. If you don't believe that, just read what it's like being a woman over there in the Middle East. You'll get the picture. And the story of Michal, the daughter of Saul, falls in line with this very pattern. Her story is not, it's not a simple one. It's not a joyous one. It's rather melancholy, but it's highly instructive for women who find themselves in a less than desirable position. Her name was Michal, M-I-C-H-A-L. We did this message, by the way, almost exactly 10 years ago, but I dare say most of you were not around to hear it, so we're gonna redo it today. Now, I need you to make your way to the Gospel of 1 Samuel. That would be on page 201 in the Church Bible. 1 Samuel chapter 18. There were two men in Michal's life. One was her husband and the other was her father. Her father was King Saul, and he answers to the flesh, that part of our composition that we have to fight, as we saw last 2 weeks when we taught about a bloodless war. And her husband, David, answers to the Spirit. Saul was rejected by God. David was called a man after God's own heart. We're kind of spiritualizing a little bit. I generally shy away from spiritualizing because you can get quite subjective with it. But in this case, I think it's got legs. In this case, I think you can get away with it. The Saul side of her, or the David side of her, if we translate this into spiritual terms. The curtain opens in 1 Samuel 18. Now, David has slain Goliath in chapter 17. He's the national military hero of the area. Saul is noticing that he has more acclaim than he, Saul, and so Saul is very jealous of him, and Saul's thinking about, how do I do away with this guy? And in verse 17 is where our curtain opens. Then Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter Merav. I will give her to you as a wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him. So David said to Saul, well, who am I and what is my life and my father's family in Israel that I should be son-in-law to the king? But it happened as time went on that Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, but she was given instead to Adriel, the Meholathite, as a wife. All right, now I don't know what happened here. There was an arranged marriage. David was going to get the older sister. For some reason, the arrangement got nixed. So now we have an alternative, verse 20. Now look at this. Now Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. This is the only instance in all of biblical narrative where we're told a woman loved a man. This is the only one. She loved David, and they told Saul, and the thing pleased him. In other words, as the British say, she fancied him. And so Saul here, oh, she fancies him. This is going to work out just fine. Why is he thinking this is going to work out just fine? Because he's genuinely concerned about his younger daughter's well-being. Nay, because this helps to further his malevolent designs against David. Look at verse 21. So Saul said, okay, I will give her to him that she may be a snare to him and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore, Saul said to David a second time, you shall be my son-in-law today. But he had to perform an elementary task. And it wasn't bring him the broomstick of the wits of the West. It was actually, he wanted 100 Philistines slain and bring the proof of the slaying before him, and we won't get into the details of the proof. But David went out and actually killed 200 of them, and so there was very little Saul could say. And if you drop down to verse 28, thus Saul saw and knew that the Lord was with David, and we're going to be told this again, dear friends, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him. Twice within 10 verses we're told that this girl loved this man. Now I want you to mark that. She is genuinely in love with her husband. Now I would say she's dealt four aces here. This is a very good hand. She's the king's daughter. She marries the national war hero. There are probably 100 other women who just swoon when David walks by. We're told in 1 Samuel 16, he ain't half bad looking either. So she's got the JFK Jr. You remember JFK Jr., the country's most eligible bachelor for a number of years? She's got the JFK Jr. In her circle with a wedding ring on her finger. This is four aces. She's got a good, this is a betting hand right here. Now, our next port of call is chapter 19, 1 Samuel 19. The story moves on. Verse 8, and there was war again. Now, let me stop. You know, when has there not been war? I mean, I read this and I say, why do we have to have a war? But we do. Actually, if you want to look at a verse, when you get a chance, Romans 3 and verse 17, Paul says, under inspiration, and the way of peace they have not known, they meaning mankind. They have not known the way of peace. Look at it again. So another war. All right, there was war again. That was free. And David went out and fought with the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. Now the distressing spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand, and David was playing music with his hand. And Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away from Saul's presence, and he drove the spear into the wall. So David fled and escaped that night. All right, verse 11. So Saul sent messengers to David's house to watch him. All right, he sent the FBI to surveil David's house and to kill him in the morning. And Michal, now mark this, saints. Here she's called the wife of David. She's not always going to be called the wife of David, but here the writer of 1 Samuel is going to call her the wife of David, told him saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you're going to be killed. Because she understood the malevolent designs her dad had on him, that is her husband. So Michal let David down through a window, and he went, and he fled, and he escaped. Clearly at this point, her allegiance is to her husband rather than her father. Many women, as I'm going to show you, are faced with that fork in the road. Do I go with my dad or my husband? When there's a conflict between the two, she's with the husband here, at the expense of the favor of her dad. And then Michal, oh gosh, she took an more on this in a, this is not good, but more on this in a minute. She took an image and laid it in the bed, put a cover of goat's hair for his head, and covered it with clothes. And so when Saul sent messengers to take David, she said, well, he's sick. Then Saul sent the messengers back to see David, saying, bring him to me in the bed that I may kill him. So when the messengers had come in, there was the image in the bed and a cover of goat's hair for his head. And then Saul looks at his daughter Michal and says, why have you deceived me like this, girl, and sent my enemy away so that he has escaped? And Michal doesn't know what to say, so she says, well, he said to me, let me go, I'll kill you. Why should I kill you? And then verse 18, so David fled and escaped and went to Samuel at Ramah and told him all that Saul had. Boy, I'll bet they had a lot to talk about, those two. I'll bet they had quite a conversation. And he and Samuel went and stayed at Naioth. Now, as I say, many a woman has had to choose between her husband and her father when a major brouhaha erupts in the family. I'll tell you another one was Joan Setnar. We talked about Joan Setnar, who was born Joan Kress of Kmart fame, and it was a question between her dad, the Jehovah's Witness family, and her husband Bill, who was on the fast track out of Jehovah's Witnesses. She hung with Bill, her husband, and said goodbye to that huge inheritance. Remember we talked about that? That she would have received as the great-granddaughter, the guy who started what came to be known as Kmart. There's another situation. So it's not uncommon that we have that. But this thing in verse 13, this is not good. Michal took an image. Brother McGovern, what's with this image thing? The Hebrew is a teraphim. What is that? It is a little bitty idol. These are household figurines that the Israelites just seem to be infatuated with all throughout the, just a form of idolatry that they seem to be infatuated with. Now, Rachel did the same thing, the same exact thing. You can look this up later, but it's in Genesis 31. Genesis 31 and verse 34. Jacob realizes that Laban, his father-in-law, doesn't like him anymore. So in the dead of night, he takes Rachel, the cattle, the household goods, everything just kind of leaves. And then Laban finds out in the morning they all left. He's mad as a hornet. He overtakes them where they were and just reads Jacob the riot act. And then he says, hey, man, you stole my gods, my teraphim. And Jacob didn't know this. And so Rachel is, she puts it in a camel saddle in her tent and sits on it. So Jacob had said, come search the tent. I don't have it. He didn't know that Rachel had it. So Rachel's sitting on the, and you know, they're coming in the tent and all. And she says, look, I can't, she says, I can't get up. The manner of women is with me. Translation, it's my time of the month. I got cramps. You're not going to make me do this. And of course, what man is going to, you know, I mean, any man's going to say, get me out of here. But no. He searched and searched, but she was allowed to keep sitting there. And there was the household idols. So my point is, Rachel did this too, but this is like 1600 B.C., maybe 1700 B.C., Ten Commandments are hundreds of years forthcoming. Here, with Michal, this late in Israel's history, there's no way she doesn't know this is wrong. So I'm saying this is not good. She knows better than to have these dumb little idol figurines in the house. What is she doing with this? I can't conceive of David having this in the house. I'm appending this to Michal, and she's using it, you know, to help forward this ruse that she's pulling. But what we see here is her faith in Yahweh is compromised. She's got these figurines, these teraphim that she's using. And then, you know, she's going to go ahead and tell this lie about David, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. I don't think she's all that terribly guilty here because this is a stressful situation. In any event, in verse 18, the curtain closes. And what do we have? Well, I think we have a woman who's not in a good situation. It was dealt four aces at first, but now the next hand, not coming up so good. She's got a pair of tens. I mean, it's like not that terribly good. Certainly not a betting hand. Look, her actual, let's say her domestic situation is not good. She's a king's daughter who ought to be loved by a father who was incapable of giving her any love. This father sees her as a pawn on his chessboard to move about as he sees fit. As you will see, we're not through with her operating as a pawn with his thumb, forefinger, and middle finger on to move around on the chessboard. So her domestic situation is not good. The youngest daughter is supposed to be the apple of daddy's eye. She clearly is not. This has to be getting to her. And then she's the wife of the national hero, yes, but her husband is having to flee and run around the countryside, and she's not going to see him for a good long time. And he was given to her for political expediency. Remember, David acquired Michal. It wasn't like there was a courtship. And you do see some courtships in the Old Testament. They weren't all arranged marriages, but this is one. And it was one that didn't work out to her overall long-term benefit. Her domestic situation is not good. Now her husband's gone. Her spiritual situation is not good either, because her spiritual frame of reference is Saul. This tells us she was not brought up in the godliest of households. Saul is a blueprint for spiritual failure. Those of you who have been over here for a few years, how many messages have we done on Saul as a blueprint for failure? If you want to know how to end up on a dung heap, follow Saul's example. We've been over this several times. So her spiritual example or pattern is her father. That's not good. She's not raised in a godly household, so her walk with the Lord is potentially at least flawed. Exhibit A is the teraphim. Exhibit B is this tall tale she tells him about David, although in her defense we have to say, maybe she's thinking, my father is so nuts, if I don't tell this outlandish lie, he might kill me. So I'm going to give her the benefit of that doubt, because Saul is mentally unbalanced, and we know that he's mentally unbalanced because it's a distressing spirit from the Lord. You remember when we taught on a post-truth generation, in 2 Thessalonians 2, God will send them a delusion. God can send you anything he wants as a judgment, and he has sent this distressing spirit upon Saul. So, I don't know. Saul is now chasing her fugitive husband all over the countryside, and she's alone. Now, for some women, this is okay. You're alone, and you're okay with it. But here's the problem. When you've been happily married, and now you're cast into that alone status, there's an unwelcome visitor who tends to knock on the door and gain entrance, and that is loneliness. You can be alone without being lonely. And women, I think, can cope with being alone better than men. I think I can get away with that. But loneliness many times accompanies being alone, and that's where this poor girl is right now. Now look, things are about to improve, but then they're going to take a nosedive. Now, our next port of call is 1 Samuel 25. This is a pivotal passage. I need you to turn to 1 Samuel 25. As we look at look at verse 40. So David has had his interaction with Abigail and then Nabal, her whacked out husband whom God dropped. Now, Abigail is available. Verse 40. So when the servants of David had come to Abigail at Carmel, they spoke to her saying, David sent us to you to ask you to become his wife. Oh my gosh, you call this a proposal? I mean, a second-hand proposal? Can you imagine Sandy as a young girl and Stu is going to send a friend of his to say, Stu wants to know if you'll be his wife. I don't think Sandy's going to have any of that. What a proposal. You know, today they get up in the football stands. Isn't that how Stevie proposed to his wife? You get on your knees in front of 100 people with the ring and beg them. This is a big deal today. Or you get somebody to skywrite, instead of surrender Dorothy, they write, will you marry me? And this guy, something like this. So, boy, things have come a long way. So this is the proposal. David sent us to you to ask you to become his wife. Oh, my gosh. Verse 41, then she arose, bowed her face to the earth and said, here is your maidservant, a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord. Oh, my gosh. Boy, in today's feminist world, this is not going to obey. Betty Friedan, who started the feminist movement in the early 60s with that book, The Feminine Mystique, Betty Friedan would just have a coronary over this. What do you mean wash the feet? But Abigail is deferential. This is one of David's good moves here. Remember, God is allowing polygamy, and Abigail has a very, very good head on her shoulder, as we have seen from what precedes here in chapter 25. But, okay, we're let in on this information. Now, David's going to acquire Abigail for a while. All right, so Abigail rose in haste and rode on a donkey, verse 42, attended by five of her maidens, and she followed the messengers of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, so both of them were his wives. Now look at verse 44. But Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was from Galim. Now here she's called the daughter of Saul and the wife of David. This is kind of important, all right? But you need to know this, that this is a purely political move on the part of Saul carried out in order to strip David of any claim to the throne. That's all this is about. Nothing more. So once again, this poor woman is nothing but a pawn on her father's, well, political chessboard. And finally, Saul's going to die. He's going to leave the stage in chapter 31 when he gets killed in the Battle of Gilboa, and subsequent thereto, she's going to become involved again in a political struggle between two powerful men as nothing more than a pawn on a chessboard. Now, our next port of call is 2 Samuel chapter 3. We're jumping over a lot of the details of the life of David, which don't concern us today. But in 2 Samuel 3, we have some more significant language. Look at verse 12. All right, Abner. Who is Abner? Remember, that is Saul's battle general. Abner is a military man, and he's making a political deal with David. They're huddling behind, you know, the smoke-filled room, you know, the political deal in the smoke-filled room. That's what this is. Abner sent messengers on his behalf to David saying, whose is the land? We went over this when we taught on sowing and reaping. You've seen this before. Whose is the land? You got the legal claim to it, David, but guess what? We're occupying it. Saying also, make your covenant with me. If you bring me on into your administration, make me Secretary of Defense. That's what he wants. He wants a cabinet post. You make your covenant with me. Indeed, my hand will be with you to bring all Israel to. I can deliver the tribes to you if I'm Secretary of Defense. That's what's going on here. And David said, yeah, fine, good. I'll make a covenant with you. But one thing I require of you, here's part of the deal, Charlie Brown. You shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see my face. Abner says, all right, that can be arranged. So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michal, whom I betrothed to myself for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, son of Laish. So she was given to Paltiel. He's also called Palti in another place. And it looks like this man genuinely loved her. Then her husband went along with her to Bahurim, weeping behind her. And Abner said to him, get out of here. Go return. And so he returned. In other words, this would be like trying to fight Chuck Norris, you know, Walker, Texas Ranger. You're not going to beat up Chuck Norris. So Abner is a military man, And poor Palti, I mean, he might be a tailor or a cobbler. He don't know how to fight, so he can't stand up to Abner. Get out of here. So he has to do that. Just get out of here. Now recall that, as I said, Michal had been given to Palti over there in chapter 25. Now here's my question. Was that a happy marriage? You know, I don't know. He might have cursed like a sailor. He may have had horrible personal hygiene habits. Maybe he didn't know how to save money. Every dollar they brought in the house, he went out and spent. Maybe that's it. But at least he loved her. All indications are she was finally with a man who genuinely loved her. But now she's forcibly stripped from him, forcibly separated. He's thrown out of the house. She's dragged back to David. Now here you got a terrible hand of cards. I mean, she's got a pair of threes. This is a bad situation to be in. She's very unhappy, and she has solid reasons for it. And a lot of women out there, very unhappy. That's why you have this woman. You can see what some women have to go through, Bill McGovern. I had a husband, but he's forsaken me. He left. You know, abandonment is legal grounds for a divorce in many states. I think in Louisiana, too. Abandonment is grounds for, when we first started renting out our stuff, man, this was 30 years ago. And I think Michelle was right there when that girl, Pat, had a 13-year-old and three triplets, little bitty kids. And I'm talking to her about renting this apartment. And what does your husband do? Well, he left me. What? Well, he came up to me and said, I just can't deal with this anymore, and left. So we're thinking, what is God going to do with some of these men? Yeah, he just saddled her with the 13-year-old, three triplets that are this high, and just left. So, Brother McGovern, I had a husband, but he's forsaken me. Or, Brother McGovern, I have a husband who didn't love me, and I think he's a womanizer. You got a lot of this. And the issue now for this unhappy woman is, do I hang with him, parentheses, for the sake of the children, or do I throw him out, or do I leave? Or what have you. I saw this when we were building our health club in Opelousas, and I was signing up people. Before the thing was built, there was a woman whose name was Christine. I can still see this woman. They lived in this huge home. The husband was a horse guy, raised horses, a lot of money, and he was a big womanizer in the town, and everybody knew it. And I wasn't even saved. I was about a year away from getting saved, and I remember I looked at this woman, and I got the picture instantly. Okay. Big, beautiful house. You're alone in this house. He's off running around with some woman. She's only marginally happy, if best. I will never forget that. You do have that situation. I'm married. He takes care of me, but I got to put up with this Joseph Smith stuff, this roving eye that he has. But McGovern, I had a husband, but he's dead, and life is tough without him. Look, that's not a good situation to be in either. Am I lonely? I don't know. I haven't decided yet. I'm alone. I'm not sure if I'm lonely or not. Some women will say, yes, I'm alone, and I'm lonely. I want to get remarried. There's nothing wrong with that. Brother McGovern, I never had a husband because I never met Mr. Wright. Mr. Wright has not come along. Well, that's a respectable position because it's far better for you to realize Mr. Wright has not come along. Then a guy come along and you think is Mr. Wright, and then after the papers are signed, you find out he ain't Mr. Wright. Because divorce lawyers are expensive. So there's nothing wrong with that. Brother McGovern, I have a husband. No major problems, but I'm just dissatisfied with life. I'm not so sure I'm treated as well as I could be treated. Or my career's taking a nosedive. I'm married. I'm in this position. I don't know what to say. I'm not so sure I'm happy. Look, a lot of women find themselves in a lot of situations that involve romance. Not your walk with the Lord, or not the job, or not your health, but romance. What do we do? Well, look, Michal had two influences in her life, her husband and her father. Remember, the father answers to the flesh. The husband answers to the spirit, even though David had a lot of warts still. Saul is nonetheless a blueprint for failure. David is still called a man after God's own heart. Now, as a contemporary woman in the 21st century up here in Pennsylvania, what are we to do? you're faced with this relatively melancholy set of circumstances. We're going to address this in just a little while, but I want to put this taste in your mouth. It's Psalm 27 and verse 1. We're going to be there in a few minutes. But in Psalm 27 and verse 1, you have this stupendous statement, "The Lord is the strength of my life." That's something you need to chomp down on and keep your teeth clamped into. And don't lose sight of the big picture. The big picture meaning we're here to serve God, etc. We're going to deal with this in a few minutes, but I wish I had a few words that could constitute a magic wand that could reverse your circumstances, but I really don't. But we do have Mikal as a blueprint for an example, not necessarily to follow, because her end is not good either. Well, where Mikal is concerned, I have to say she appears to have allowed her father's influence to prevail. In other words, I think she kind of more gave in to the Saul side of her spiritual makeup than the David side. And we have some evidence to back this up. She seems, I'm saying, to have withdrawn in a degree of bitterness, and this is not what you want. And then we come to the last mention of Mikal, and it's in 2 Samuel 6. We were here a few weeks ago, maybe 2 or 3, 4 months ago, when we taught on worship. If you remember, we were in this passage, and we're going to have to revisit it, but examining it through a different lens. In 2 Samuel 6, what has happened? Well, here's what's happened. The Ark of the Covenant had been captured by the Philistines. The Philistines thought they had a big old prize, and God sent them a bunch of hemorrhoids. And they said, "Oh my gosh, what are we going to do?" And the priest said, "I know why you got the hemorrhoids. It's this ark thing. Get it out of here." So they got the ark out. It ended up in the home of Obed-Edom, who's a devout, probably convert to, you know, Yahweh's religion. And God blessed Obed-Edom because he was respectful of the ark, etc. And now the ark's ready to be brought into Jerusalem. So there's a lot of fanfare, trumpets, champagne, streamers, confetti, all this. In verse 12, let's start at verse 12. It was told King David, saying, "The Lord has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that belongs to him because of the ark of God." All right? So David went and brought up the ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom. He probably lives in the suburbs. Now they're going to come into the city of David, that would be Jerusalem, with gladness, a lot of fanfare, etc. And so it was, verse 13, when those bearing the ark of the Lord had gone 6 paces, that he sacrificed oxen and fatted sheep. There's a reason for the 6 paces, but we can't get into it. It's to chase a rabbit. But they sacrificed oxen and fatted sheep. I'll tell you what that means. God's going to accept the ark this time. He didn't accept it a few verses before, and it cost somebody his life. All right, now, verse 14, the plot thickens. Then David danced before the Lord with all his might, and David was wearing a linen ephod, meaning he's usurping informally the office of a priest. It's not a sacrilegious thing, but he's in a sacrificial mood, let's say. Now, David's dancing before the Lord with all his might. Now, let's get to Mikal. She's a spectator. Are we going to go with Saul or are we going to go with Saul's dignity or David's zeal? Which one? Well, let's see. Verse 15. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. There's fanfare, there's music. All the trumpets are playing. Everybody's happy. And verse 16, now as the ark of the Lord came into the city of David, Mikal, but now she's not called the wife of David. Now under inspiration, she's called the daughter of Saul. Mikal, daughter of Saul, looked through a window and saw King David. And it's not David, and it's not her husband. They're very subtle, different. It's King David, leaping and whirling before the Lord, and she despised him in her heart. Well, look, you don't need to be a marriage counselor with an office and a couple of degrees on the wall to figure out this is going to be an unhappy situation, and there's already a lot of tension between these two. We don't need a degree in psychology to figure some of this out. Now, when it says leaping and whirling, these, as I've told you before, on what they call the PL stem in Hebrew, that's the stem of intensity, which means he was really, really leaping and really, really whirling, let's say, in exaggerated fashion. And this is somewhere between embarrassing and infuriating in the eyes of his wife, who's going to let her Saul genes predominate here. Shouldn't have done that. But we can guess, when we read this, where her head and her heart have been. I think that she's bitter, and she's had it with David for a number of reasons. We're going to go over them in just a minute. But you're looking at the result of a woman who has retreated, I think, in a cocoon of bitterness, and it's not unwarranted totally, because she does not have a good hand. She went from four aces to a pair of threes, and that's it. But McGovern, why in the world should she be so bitter? Well, she has a very unhappy set of personal circumstances with which she has to deal, and let me say she's, at this point, allowing the Saul side of her to predominate over the David side. The Saul side is dignity, uprightness, let's keep our cool, let's be British. The British do not like displays of them. Maybe the French do, but not the Brits. They are formal and straight-laced. Let's be British about this. Let's be a British monarch, and even worse, the Italians. You know, the Italians talk with their hands, and we're not going to be an Italian monarch. We're going to be a British monarch. We're going to keep our composure and be sophisticated and elegant. And what she sees is anything but sophisticated and elegant, and she is nauseated. But there's a lot going on beyond just this initial sight of David and this onset of nausea upon seeing him. I think there's a lot more that's been brewing over the years. So she's watching David. She's anything but happy. So they brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place in the midst of the tabernacle that David had erected for it. And David offered burnt offerings and peace offerings before the Lord, hence that linen ephod. He's going to do some sacrificing. All right. And when David had finished offering burnt offerings and peace offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord of hosts. Everybody's happy. This is a festive occasion, but not everybody. There's one person in this scene who's not so happy. Then he distributed among all the people, the whole multitude of Israel, both the women and the men, to everyone a loaf of bread, a piece of meat, a cake of raisins, etc., etc. And so all the people departed, everyone to his house. They're beginning to depart. They're beginning to disperse. There's a crowd in the quadrangle, let's say, beginning to go home. The palace seems to be in the middle of the city. You don't have Solomon's mansion. Solomon is either in diapers or has not been born yet. That big mansion that took Solomon, I don't know, 10, 20 years to build, whatever it was, that's not built yet. So they're still living in a nice little home called the palace in the middle of town. Verse 20. So David returns to bless his household, and here Saul's spiritual genes go on display. And Michal, and here it is again, dear friends, not the wife of David, the daughter of Saul, came out to meet David. Now, she was so furious, get the scene, she could not wait for David to get to the threshold. She had to walk out on the lawn and greet him in the street in front of all these people with this blast of her disapproval. We've been here. When I was in New Orleans, we lived on Lake Trail. We had a guy across the street, the nicest guy you ever met. But boy, that wife of his, she could really be contrary. And one day, I'm on my lawn, and she came up to this guy and started giving him what for. And I remember, he said, Debbie, the neighbors. I don't care about the neighbors. And I'm oh my God, I need a drink of water. So I had to go inside. I didn't want to be anywhere around this. But I've seen this, public display of disapproval, right there on the lawn. I can kind of relate to this. So she walks out on the lawn, if I can put it that way. She's so mad. She can't wait for David to get to the threshold of the door. And in verse 20, she says this: "How glorious was the king of Israel today, uncovering himself today in the eyes of the maids of his servants, as one of the base fellows shamelessly uncovers himself." What she's saying is, you were jumping so high that pink underwear you have on was visible, and all the little maids were just titillated watching that pink designer underwear of yours, David. No, she's furious. Look, all of this pent-up rage that's in her now explodes on the lawn. People are probably within earshot. The crowd doesn't just disappear suddenly. They're ready to go home. She sees they're beginning to leave, and she walks out there, and they're probably still within earshot, if I'm reconstructing this accurately, so that everybody can hear how put out she is with this guy. But this pent-up rage now explodes, and I would say from several emotional fronts. And here is where you have to understand, she's not totally to be blamed here, because this is a woman who's unhappy, and she has some reasons to be unhappy. First of all, this insufferable man she's married to just plain doesn't know how to behave like a king. Kings don't do this. She came from Saul's house. There's no way Saul's doing this. The way she was trained, kings conduct themselves with a lot more elegance and sophistication, see. So this insufferable man is a monumental embarrassment to her. Secondly, this is another reason you have all this pent-up rage inside of her. He gets all the attention. Now, she used to. She's the youngest daughter of the king. But he gets all the attention. And now, all she is just another member of his harem. That's it. This is hard to deal with when you've been brought up a certain way. Another reason the pent-up rage explodes is because she was torn away forcibly from Palti. He may have had bad personal hygiene. He may have cursed like a sailor, etc. But at least he loved her. You can see that. He's following along, weeping. He don't want to lose this woman. They were married, happily married, and now she's being forcibly removed. And she can remember the days at least she slept next to a guy who loves her. So that's another thing. Now, she's just another member of, well, that, you know what she is now? She's a neglected co-wife. That's what she is. See, Emma Hale was in the same boat. I'm not going to share this guy with all these other women. See, but she was forced to. I mean, you're going to believe section 132 of D&C. God's thundering down from heaven, if you can believe that, that she has to do this. I mean, that's so flaky, you can box it and sell it as cereal. That whole section 132 thing. In this dispense, on this side of Calvary, no. Mm-mm. So, like Emma Hale, who was Emma Hale Smith, she's going to be just another neglected co-wife to share her husband with, well, all these other women. All right? Also, don't lose sight of this, dear friends. The house of Saul is obliterated. Now, wait a minute. Don't take the politics out of this. Saul's dynasty was in place, up and running, until look at 1 Samuel 15. I'll show you where he loses it. You keep a finger here, but look at 1 Samuel 15. Saul's persistent disobedience, his insistence that he disobey God, cost him everything. In 1 Samuel 15, 28, Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to an associate, a neighbor, an associate of yours," that would be David, "who is better than you." At that point right there, as far as God's concerned, Saul is an illegitimate king. So the kingship was stripped from him there. Even though it's like a chicken with the head cut off, it kept going. But as far as God's concerned, David's going to be the next king, and he is the king. But there was a time when she had access to the White House. She was in the White House. She was part of all the fawning press, and everybody wanted to know about the first family and all this kind of stuff. And now that's all gone. See, all gone. So the house of Saul is obliterated. I mean, her political, the enjoyment of the political dynasty is out the window. Gone. And here's another thing. This is a big nail in that coffin. It looks like that the love she had for David, and we know she loved him. We were told twice in 1 Samuel 18 that she loved David. But you can see that love has to be nurtured. You can lose it over time. I've seen this before. And the love she had for David is now turned sour, if not acidic. Now she has no more love for she. This is a, and it's not her fault entirely, but a victim of circumstances. She is evolving into a bitter woman, an embittered woman. It looks like every single biblical evidence points to that conclusion. So David responds with a stout rebuke, verse 21. So David said to Michal, "Look, woman, it was before the Lord who chose me instead of your father and all his house to appoint me ruler over the house of the Lord over Israel. Therefore, I will play music before the Lord, and, verse 22, I will be even more undignified than this and will be humble in mine own sight." Translation, as the song says, "You ain't seen nothing yet. But as for the maidservants of whom you have spoken, by them I will be held in honor." In other words, they're twice as spiritual as you are. This is a high insult. She's mad at him. He's mad at her. But it looks like the love has gone out of that relationship. And the divine stamp of disapproval looks like it falls in verse 23. If I can read the vibes right, therefore Michal, he's going to say it for the third time in one chapter, the daughter of Saul had no children to the day of her death. What are we to make of that? One of two things. Either God weighed in on her unfavorably for whatever reason, and she remained childless because the Lord, and he is perfectly capable of doing this, closed her womb. Or, and here's another viable option, David didn't touch her from that day forward. It could be, it's one of those two. Could be both, but probably one of those two. And you're looking at the culminating rejection of Saul in verse 23, because after this verse, all vestiges of Saul's influence vanished. This is it. This is the culminating rejection of the house of Saul. It's kind of like the cap on the whole sordid, melancholy story. It's placed right here in verse 23. So she has no children. This is considered a curse. Forget the modern day view of that, where children are a disease. I mean, pregnancy is a disease. Abortion is preferable, and children are just a fate worse than death. Back then, if you didn't have children, it was a stamp of disapproval, or at least it was deemed that way. I want to read to you from Alta. All right, Robert Alta. Well, when I was in a doctoral program, I had to read this book and digest it. Robert Alta is a professor of Hebrew at Berkeley. He is the cat's meow for Old Testament scholarship. They love Alta, and he's brilliant. He's brilliant. He's forgotten more Bible than I've ever learned. When I did my dissertation and they flunked it the first time, one of the complaints was, "You didn't include Alta in this dissertation. You only mentioned him. You didn't include Alta." And I'm thinking, what, does he walk on water and turn it into wine? I didn't know they loved him that way. They did. And it's because he really is brilliant. When I sat in my carrel in the library and read this for the first time, I can remember, wait, I never saw that. I never saw that either. Ten pages down, I'm writing on it. I'll look this up later. Write down, look it up later. This guy's got so much insight, and he doesn't believe one word of it. Not one. Half a dozen times in the book, he says, it's all fiction. So, but he's brilliant. He's just telling his colleagues, look, I'm reporting on this, but I don't really believe it. However, I want to read this to you on page 124. Listen to this. He talks about the writer of 1 Samuel, and this is what he says, talking about the writer. He, the writer, does not question the historically crucial fact of David's divine election, meaning God choosing David to be king. So the writer doesn't question the historically crucial fact of David's divine election, so prominently stressed by the king himself at the beginning of his speech. We just read that. But theological rights do not necessarily justify domestic wrong. He's taken up for Mikol. Alta takes up for Mikol here. Theological rights do not necessarily justify domestic wrongs, and the anointed monarch of Israel may still be a harsh and unfeeling husband to the woman who, after all, did love him and at one time saved his life. That's true. That's a very insightful remark. So Alta takes up for Mikol. This is a mixed bag. You can look at this story any number of ways. But the moral of the Brahma government, what am I supposed to take home from this? Well, the moral of the story is this. There are many unhappy women in the world. I mean, I have to admit this. Most of them live in the Middle East. But some of them live over here, too, in America. And they're divided into two classes, redeemed and unredeemed. Now, if you want to see a really bad situation, go to the Middle East where you have women in a horrible vice grip, and they're unredeemed. They're hanging on to this empty bag we know as Mohammedism and going to die that way. I mean, this is horrible. That's why most of the converts in the Middle East are women. Far and away, they're women. Far more women come to the Lord in the Middle East than men, for obvious reasons. But the redeemed women who find themselves in an unfortunate set of circumstances still have a huge advantage, and that's the Lord. Now, look at page 377 in the Church Bible as we wind this down. I want to give you something to take home. Not that everybody in front of me is miserable. You may be quite happy and content with your life. I don't know. This is for each and every one to wrestle with and to get what he or she can out of a message like this. But look at Psalm 27. We'll look at verse 1 again. This is, well, the husband of Michal right here, David. Verse 1, the Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? This is the verse we quoted before. The Lord is the strength of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? And then we go on and on and on. But look at verse 10. This is a great verse. When my father and my mother forsake me. How many people who have lived and have turned to the Lord have had their father and their mother forsake them? Kick them out of the house. Jews, Mohammedans, Hindus, yes, you're disinherited and you're out of this family. When my father and my mother forsake me, or we can read, or my husband, then the Lord will take care of me. So you need to remember that's in here. When even my husband forsakes me, you have somebody to hang on to as over against these unredeemed women who don't. And then in Psalm 73, here's another one you want to latch on to in tandem with Psalm 27. Look at Psalm 73 as we begin to wind this down. But Psalm 73, I want to show you verses 25. This is Asaph's meltdown. Then he recovers toward the end of the psalm. We did a message on this 3 or 4 years ago. Psalm 73, look at verse 25. He finally recovers, right? Whom have I in heaven but you? When it's all said and done, what do I have but you, God? There is none upon earth that I desire beside you. Why is that? Because the Lord is the strength of my life, Psalm 27:10. My flesh and my heart fail, and I can be disappointed. My romantic life, romance can escape me. I've not been lucky in love, as they say in the movies. All that can fail, but God, look at it, is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Let me say, and you've heard me say this before, you don't serve God for what you think he can or should do for you. As you know, you serve God because you're here to glorify him. That's why you were created, regardless of the hand of cards that you've been dealt. And some women are dealt four aces, and then 30, 40 years later, they got a pair of twos, if that. Circumstances can change, and Mikal's story is absolutely no exception. Her story, dear friends, is here to illustrate one thing. Don't give in to the Saul side of you, and that is the flesh, and retreat into a cocoon of bitterness, because it looks like Mikal died a bitter old woman. That's what it looks like. And I'm not saying that she has a lot to be ashamed of, because circumstances were such that it would be very tempting to regress into that mode. But you want to always strive to live in the Spirit and by the Spirit, because that is your best course of action. And remember, one day this is all going to be over. And you know how life is. When you're in high school, it passes by so slowly. I mean, you remember that, right? When you're in high school, every day, you know, it's kind of like, I hate red lights. Chuck hates red lights. My oldest son hates red lights. We hate red lights. Worse than that is a school bus. When you got to get behind a school bus in your heart, worse than that is a train. And where I'm from, you got three places in that city where a train can get you, and you got to be someplace to be. One is on River Road, where it meets the city of, you know, where the parish meets the city. Now, Jefferson Highway, same train tracks, where Jefferson Parish meets Orleans, and then Metairie Road out there in Metairie. These three, you can have a train. Now, when that train goes by, it's really slow, and you're sitting here seething at that engineer, whoever he is, because you got someplace to be, and it goes by so slow. And that's how it is when you're in high school. It goes by saying, and you get to be 20, 25, it picks up a little bit, right? And then when you get to be 40, you realize my life is half over. It's really picking up. Now, what do we do? We're looking at the boxcars go like this. You know, life passes by really quickly the older you get, or so it seems. My point is, one day coming up, this is all going to be over. And that's why you want to hang on to Psalm 27:10 and Psalm 27:1 and Psalm 73, as you read. The Lord is your portion in life. He's the strength, regardless of the hand of cards you were dealt in this realm that we know as well. Romance. You with me on that?
Yeah.
Emma Hale Smith, bad hand of cards. I'm very unfortunate. Same thing for Mick Hall. You have to make the best of a bad hand sometimes. That's why you have her in the Bible. Y'all love God? Isn't God good to give you a story like this? At least, ladies, you can relate to some of this, you know. So, anyway. Well, why don't we stand? And we'll thank you. Father, we thank you so much for the story of Mick Hall, as melancholy a story, very somber story. We know, God, it's in here for a reason. You've put this woman in here with more than just a passing verse or two, so that forthcoming generations can profit from her story. I pray for all the ladies within the sound of my voice, either in front of me or listening to a CD, who can relate to this tragically enough that some of this spills over into their lives in a very realistic way. I pray, God, that you give them the grace to cope with what they have to cope with, and the realization one day, very soon, this is all going to be over. And what counts is the Lord is the strength of my life, period, regardless of our circumstances. So we submit this to you, and we pray for it right now for everybody, and we pray it in the name of Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah. Amen.